Hello and welcome to episode 26 of the Complimentary Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Langerman, joined as always by Anthony Hobday. And today we're getting into things that we are good at, opposite of things we're not good at from last week. But before we jump into this more, I guess, positive outlook on ourselves, how have you been the last 2 weeks?
I've been well. I've been thinking about this. I shouldn't date this episode, but I just posted on social media. I've been really enjoying some polls recently. And
oh, yeah.
Off the back of one of these episodes of this podcast, I posted a poll that got a lot of attention as far as polls go. That was your idea. And so you've seen firsthand how fun polls are.
Very fun.
I don't think enough people write polls about interface design or interface design related stuff. So I try to write it because now I have people who will answer the polls. It's like, yes, we can learn some things from the masses rather than just you have like one hot take and then four hot takes below it, because those are the people that responded to that one person. You can get numerical data.
Mm-hmm.
So I posted one today because I realized this would work better as a poll with a specific example. So some backstory: about, say, half a year ago, I posted and posed the question, do you think if you get a world-class designer and developer to build a website for you as a company, that that website will make you back more than what you paid the people to make it?
Ooh.
In exposure or extra sales, whatever happens to make you money through conversions, you know, is it worth building and releasing a world-class website? But I kept it generic. I kept it, non-specific. And I think that was a poll at the time, but basically everyone said no, from memory. The majority said no. So today I realized, oh, wait, we do have a world-class website that everyone knows and that definitely has had an impact, which is the Linear website. So, and I happen to know that three people worked on the website for 3 months, right? So you can basically work out how much the website cost roughly. I think rough enough to be able to ask people a question. So it was quite fun to make it much more specific instead and say, if we work out the numbers here, let's say that it costs 300 grand to make the Linear website over the course of 3 months. Do you think Linear's made back 300 grand from releasing that website? And so far, the majority of people say yes, by a long way. So I think once you make it more specific, you can see, oh, wait, everyone knows Linear, everyone's copying Linear. If this hasn't made Linear a lot of money, then what could, you know? So what's the point in building a website even?
Yeah.
So I've quite enjoyed that. But that's not been my 2 weeks, but that's just been today. Maybe I shouldn't go on for like yesterday and the day before.
That's interesting. So when you put an actual face on it, it becomes easier to quantify that you did get a return or not, especially with a face like Linear.
I suppose it's like Nike with their advertising, you know. It might cost $50 million to run an advertising campaign over the course of 5 years for Nike or something.
Mm-hmm.
For all of the creative, I'm just putting that number out of thin air because I have no idea what TV advertising costs, for example, or the billboards or the whatever it happens to be. But has that made them more than they spent on it? Probably. And it's the same with websites. You know, a lot of these websites act as brand ambassadors rather than just a place you go to see if you want to convert. So it's an interesting way to look at it and hopefully an interesting way to make a case for a really good, whatever it happens to be, in this case, a website.
Yeah, that's interesting. I enjoyed your Techmark poll. And I saw the follow-up to it yesterday, but your first poll was just check marks and your second poll was check marks in a box. And the vibe changes significantly.
So much.
I found my answer changed. I became team whatever the most popular one was. So not as upright. I think it was C or A.
40 degrees rather than 45 degrees.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still team 35 degrees because it's just, it feels like it's pointing at the corners of the box, if that makes sense.
Hmm. Which letter
was visual
that?
Balance was A, I think.
Okay.
In the very final one I posted about it, I did like a lineup and I put the... Oh, no, I did a third post where I put the degrees underneath each of the boxes. So I revealed what I was talking about. And it's because I was designing my own checkbox for an illustration for a website. And I was messing around with the angles and thinking, which looks the best? And so I thought I'll do a poll about it. But I'd sort of already come to the conclusion myself that the more upright you make it to a point, the more it feels like it feels a square better. And
yeah, the shape matters.
I think most people would assume that you should go for a 45 degree angle on the sort of long side of a tick, just because that feels sort of balanced in our head. You know, 45 degrees is halfway between 0 and 90, obviously. So yeah, I found it interesting that where you put the tick makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Well, not a big difference. It's a tiny difference, but it's noticeable.
And it's usually such a small piece of UI too. It's like when you see it really big and zoomed in, it's different than the actual size of a checkbox, which is usually like 16 pixels or smaller.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, this was for an illustration that was much bigger. So
yes, yeah.
It was more relevant. But yeah, for an actual checkbox, well, I assume most people don't even touch the default browser provided, you know, component.
We do. We do at GitHub, but it's kind of a mix of both. Well, if you don't, like, you can't, there's not much customization you can do to the browser default in terms of like sizing if you want to make it bigger. You can change the color of it, but it's kind of small. Yeah. Usually the default ones are like really tiny. So
find out the angle that GitHub uses and post.
I should. I know, because I built that component, but I just used whatever checkmark icon we already had, so I didn't really think much about it. I did add an animation to it that I think we're about to rip out, which I said, I literally said goodbye, old friend, on the pull request, because that's how I am about old CSS that I wrote. But yeah, that's a thing.
If we didn't get emotional about interfaces, Katie,
we wouldn't what have kind a of designers podcast. Are
we? Well, we wouldn't have a podcast, but also, yeah, I think we'd be bad designers.
All right, should we hop into our topic today? Things we're good at.
Yes, I think you went first last time.
Yeah. Do you want to go first this time?
I think for balance, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
So I started all of my three things that I'm good at with the letter I, but basically on purpose so that it sounded good. I'm going to change them as soon as I say them to be what I actually mean, because
yeah.
Some of these are sort of technical words that I don't like technical words. But the first one I wrote down is ideation. Basically what I mean by that is coming up with ideas, because ideation feels like way too technical for the idea of coming up with ideas. But I think this is a result of looking at so much interface design over the years, which I urge every designer to do, because the more things you put in your head, the more things you get out of your head. And it's such a simple equation. I think the reason people don't do it more is because it takes a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't look at 1,000 interfaces in a day. If you could, you might not remember them all as well as if you looked at them one a day for 1,000 days, but that's up to, you know, 3 and a bit years or whatever that less than 3 years, I think, if my math is correct. Never do math live. But yeah, so the more interface you look at, the more sort of concepts or patterns go in your head, and the more patterns come out when you try and think, oh, how could we solve this problem? And so just as a natural result of all the looking I've done, I think I'm quite good when someone says, oh, how could we solve this? Generally have, let's say, 8 different solutions that come to mind immediately, and then some more come out when I start to think about it a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, I don't know if that's true for everyone. Maybe it is. Maybe this is not something that should be on my list of things I'm good at. But I find it really useful because I remember early in my career, I might have been a bit lost at a point, being like, oh, how could we solve this? And now that never happens. So that feels good to always be an ideas person.
Yeah. I think it's a good skill to mention here. Do you find that like you're ideating and showing a lot of those ideas to other people, or is it more like a solo experience and then you present just a few of them to your peers, like at work, for example?
I work with people that probably prefer to see high fidelity stuff, and so I can't do all of those ideas in high fidelity. In the past, I've done a bit more sketching, for example, but that's been for me personally, so that I can make sure I get them all out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's helpful for reasons I'll go into later. But yeah, it's generally, I might list them. So if I'm putting it in a public place, usually it'll be in the form of a bulleted list in like I'm writing up a task description or something. I'll say, here are the ways we could approach it. And I'm partly writing it just to help me come up with the ideas. Like I said, it helps you to put them out on a piece of paper or a digital piece of paper. But it's also, if someone else wants to come along and look at the list, I might have described them in a bit more detail and they can say, oh, I like option C for this reason. I don't like option A for this reason. And so it's useful there, but I rarely, if ever, design all the different options, because you have to do it at a very low fidelity to get all of them out of your head, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you'd take months probably designing each one.
Yeah.
Properly.
Yeah. For the record, I don't think all designers do that. I think it depends, highly dependent on what you're working on. But I've definitely seen some designers kind of just come up with one solution and that's sort of it. And it's like, where's the conversation about this? Or like, where's the back and forth? And usually they're probably working by themselves. That's why I asked if you're like collaborating, because I think it might be easier to ideate when you're collaborating with other people, because you're like bouncing ideas off each other versus just by yourself. You're like maybe not as inspired to keep pushing it. So
when people say to me, oh, have you thought of this? And I hadn't thought of it, I feel bad. And that's, I know that's a natural part of being human, and especially being a designer, you're not expected. You shouldn't be expected to think of everything. But ideally, you think of as much as you can. You know, you don't think of one idea and then move on to the next phase. So I don't want to feel bad like that if I can help it. So I like to try to think of everything.
Yeah.
And so when they say, have you considered this? I can say, I did consider it. These are the reasons I didn't do it. That feels good.
It does.
So I don't want to feel bad. I do want to feel good. I don't know how clear that is as a motivation.
Yeah. I think it's nice to like have all your ducks in a row, as long as you're not defensive about it and you're more, I don't know, like sometimes it can come off as like, I already tried that and it didn't work and here's why. But this depends on who you're talking
offensive.
To.
I'm offensive about it. When they say, have you tried this? I say, that's a stupid idea and you shouldn't have had it.
Nice.
Yeah, really closes the conversation down or gets you fired. You know, it's usually one of the two.
Well, should I go into mine? It's on a little bit related. I wrote pattern recognition. So this is definitely a bit more geared towards design systems work, I guess, because a lot of what we're doing is looking for overall patterns and like trying to build consistency. But one place that I do use this a lot is in design reviews for designers outside of the design systems team, bringing their work to the design systems team, because, and not just me, but my peers on the other designers on the team, like we have the ability to be that person being like, well, have you thought of this? Because the like thing you're trying to achieve is very similar to this other pattern that we've seen in this other area. Could we just reuse that? Like, how do these two things coexist? Things like that. So I think, I'm not really sure why I have this skill. It might be just practice of when you're exposed to like such a wide variety of designs and components and teams, being on like a central team, like a design systems team, you sort of just get used to seeing similar tasks being achieved in the same way, or like you see the kind of similar solutions to problems come up. And we've gotten feedback that that's helpful. So I think it's a good skill to have, especially if you want to work on design systems.
How do you feel about this being called systems thinking, as in being good at systems thinking?
I think that's a little bit, it's related, definitely related. So when I think about systems thinking, it is about like maybe more so creating patterns, recognizing patterns, but also having the ability to create new patterns and thinking about how one small piece of something fits into the whole entire ecosystem as a whole. Definitely systems thinking. So yeah. It's related.
Because people have said to me in the past, and I hadn't really recognized this at the time, that I was good at figuring out how things can fit into a system.
Mm.
If you, over time, understand the app you're working on as a system of sort of interrelated concepts or whatever, and then someone talks about, oh, we should add this feature, and your mind starts wearing away, not about how we should design this specific component or screen or whatever, but how does this concept that you're suggesting fit into the system of concepts that represents the app in my head? So it's like your mental model, I guess. Right. Your mental model is the app model because you're the designer. So people have talked about that way of thinking, and I don't mean to steal your thunder, but people have said I'm good at it. I haven't really recognized it before they said it. And so I thought, okay, I do like to think that way. Like, I like to think very systematically.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I'm not sure systems thinking is right because it might have been stolen by those books that are about systems thinking. Like Donna Meadows? There's a famous Donna who wrote a book about systems thinking.
Okay.
That is the systems thinking book. So I think that term is sort of taken by a slightly different concept.
Yeah.
But it sounds related.
And it's not always visual, like you said. Sometimes it's about how you achieve, like, how do you get from A to B in this scenario? It's more like interaction design sometimes, which isn't always visual. It's just like, what's the actual flow like? And then how do we make it visual, or how is it not visual at all? So there's a lot of layers to it.
Yeah. One example that comes to mind, and this is not, again, specific enough maybe, but if someone said, oh, let's add this action, and it comes to mind as a designer that, oh, that action feels most similar to these actions over here. And for that sort of action, we put it in a drop-down menu. And so even though this is not an action we've had already, we should also put this in a drop-down menu because that's maybe what people will expect if they're used to how the app works. And so I think you're right, that is wrapped up in interaction design. And it's thinking about the expectations people will have and what they're informed by, I suppose.
Yeah.
When they're moving around the app. And so I think it's along those lines, like you're recognizing a pattern in something new, which is, I can see where that's very valuable as a designer, especially a systems designer.
The bigger the app, the harder it is to rein it all in too, I think. I guess your mental model is like growing too large to be in your brain at some point.
Oh, actually, we had this today. I had a discussion about, so we've got boards because we design and develop a Kanban style project management app. And we've got these boards and you can click in the little layout menu and you've got sort options. So you can sort each column in the board by, you know, when was it created or when is it due, you know, what the priority is or something. So that's useful. It's a pretty standard concept. And we've also got this thing called views where you can create essentially a query that goes and finds whatever cards you want that match your filters, and it puts them in a list, and then you can sort that list as well. We've just added the ability to sort that list. And so we've got a little drop-down menu for the sort options, just like we do in the board, right? So it's the same sort of concept in two different places.
Mm-hmm.
But in one case, you're creating a query to create that view manually. So you're saying, show me everything that's assigned to me and that was created in the last month. And in another place, the query is built into the app. It's saying, show me everything that belongs to this board, right? It's just like an SQL query in the background going and fetching the cards. And so today we're having a discussion about whether in the view where you're creating your own query with filters, whether the sort order should be a part of the saved filters.
Mm.
So can you change the sort order without having to sort of resave the view and commit that sort order to the structure of the view, if that makes sense? So whenever someone visits this view, always show them in this sort order.
Right.
And that was quite a tricky question to answer. And we haven't really come to a good conclusion because in my head, I know that in the background, that's not how boards work. The query's already been done. It's already gone and fetched the cards. And you're applying the view as a sort of temporary change to how the cards are laid out. But the sort order, you're applying that rather. And then in the view, you're applying it sort of permanently. So went back and forth in my head about that, and it felt wrong that the same concept was being used in slightly different ways. But then does the person who's using the app know that they're being used in slightly different ways? Like it's
user testing, I think, is probably the only way.
Yeah. Fun.
All right, let's move on to your next one.
My next I is iteration. And this one I might leave as iteration, but basically what I mean is if I settle on an idea where I've come up with lots of ideas and I settled on one. I happen to know that good design takes about 15 iterations. That's the number in my head. Because I've seen that number or thereabouts in lots of different contexts. So I've realized actually there's probably some kind of magical reasoning behind 15 being a good number of iterations. And so I've gotten used to, and I hope good at, basically iterating on something and trying lots of different versions of that thing. Because I think in the past, I found it easy to run out of steam and be like, I don't know what else to do with this. Now I can sort of keep iterating for a long time. And my series of frames in Figma stretches on to the right, you know, for a long time.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I can do that because I know that quality depends on quantity. And so it feels good to be able to just keep going. Even if I do need to go and show it to someone, they might give me a little bit of, I think we talked about this last time, give me a little bit of sort of mental energy to keep going even more.
Yeah.
I just need some feedback or a little word of encouragement or something. And then I can do, you know, 7 more iterations on the same concept or something. And so for the past few years, at least, I found that quite easy, which I'm glad about because quality demands quantity.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like this is a skill that you improved then. Like it was difficult for you at one point and now it's easy for you.
I think it's related to ideation in the sense that I've been seeing a lot of different ways to do things. But I think it's also that I quite enjoy the exhaustive nature of iteration where let's say you've got a button and a field. It's hopefully relatively easy to think through all of the different layout combinations that button and that field could go in. And so you can put the button inside the field with a little, you know, gap around it. You can put it connected to the field so they look like one sort of unified element, but they've got a divider in between them. You can put it to the right of the field. You could put it to the left of the field, which no one would do, but you could think about it at least. Just the same, you could put it above the field. So you've got the button first and the field afterwards, which again, no one would do, but you could consider it. And so you basically got all of these options you can try just because you're exhausting the sort of limits of the 2D plane you're designing on.
Right.
And all of the, you're thinking through all the combinations or relationships those things could have visually. And so that's not really about ideation so much as it is being able to recognize all the possibilities and then just cycling through them.
Yeah.
And when you get 3 elements, not just a button and a field, but a button and a field and a label, suddenly you've got that many more possible visual relationships. Yep. And so I quite enjoy the ability to cycle through all of those. And I think that's less about ideation and more about, recognizing possibilities that.
Mm-hmm.
That yep. feels like it's something that you can practice or
definitely.
Hopefully. I don't know. Maybe it's my brain works that way. I'm not sure.
I think you are a systems thinker. That's definitely like something you do as a systems designer, not in the way that you're describing, but more in the way of like, here's a button component. What are all the variant? What are all the possible ways this button could be rendered, which means a million because you could have an icon before the label or after the label. It could be all of these different variants, color variants and states, and it could be a drop down button, like things like that. So it's kind of mechanical. You're really just like going through every scenario and making sure you're covering your bases.
I think I'd enjoy design systems work more and probably would be good at it if I enjoyed components in Figma more.
Or you just skip Figma and do the code part. Or maybe it will get less painful to do components in Figma someday. I don't know. It's already
hopefully
gotten a little bit better.
Well, it's gotten more powerful. I don't know if that's better.
Yeah.
I'd like some magical ability to cover all these situations, but only have one sort of variant, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what that looks like.
There was a tweet recently about like how exhausting it is to do some of these things in Figma compared to code. And I just completely relate to that. Like the thought of me going in and building a component in Figma versus code it's exhausting. Like it's physically, I'm like, oh, it's just draining. It's not like energizing in any way compared to writing code, which feels more involved and progressive and you're seeing things update in real time and then you open a pull request and you're looking at the beautiful thing you just made and then anyways people get to see it.
You know that concept of flow people talk about?
Yeah.
Where you sort of lose track of time and then 6 hours later you're like, oh, it's lunchtime.
Yep.
Or oh, I missed lunchtime completely. It'd be nice if flow just stopped at lunchtime. It's like, hey, wake up. Or not wake up. Pay attention. Basically, the only time I get that is when I write code.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a bit bold statement.
That's the reason I want to stay away from code. I don't like that I can easily give 6 hours to code when that's like too much time for something that's meant to be a smaller part of my focus or my career or my job. So yes, I could be building components in code and things if I wanted to get into design systems work. But I don't want to touch the code because it's dangerous. It's like a drug or something.
I think I'm seeing where I've taken some wrong turns potentially in my career because I just take all the drugs of the code.
Yeah, someone's going to clip that out of context. Take out the code part. I take all the drugs.
I take all the drugs. If you know me, yeah, the complete opposite.
Yeah, so that's what bothers me is I do like code and I have really enjoyed it when I've done it in the past, but it's not even addictive. It's like, I don't like anything that means that I can't step away from it easily. In the past, I think when my partners come to me and said, oh, can we go and do this? I'm like, oh, I've really got something to do right now. I can't get free until like 2 hours from now. It's because I'm coding. And that, I don't like that. I want to be able to step away from my computer at the drop of a hat.
You don't want to dream about code and then wake up and like, oh, I have the solution now. I'm going to hop on my computer and fix it. Because that's kind of what happens. It's one of those things that's just like always running in your head. I respect your work-life balance boundaries here. I think it's fair. But okay, speaking of work-life balance, my next thing I'm good at, I think, is balance, which by that, I don't mean work-life balance, but like that is fine too.
This segue is so good.
I'm really butchering this segue. That's why you do the segues. I think
it's
A classes.
It's 98% at least.
For me, balance means stuff like layout and alignment and white space. So like, I just think we've talked about these things many times in various episodes, but I think probably just from my graphic design training, that was like a big focus of that. And so I think I'm strong in that area. And I think it's reflected in my visual design work or UI design work. And I think it's like there are rules, obviously, that you can follow, but I think I am able to kind of spot things. I think you've tweeted about this recently. Like you can, on a screen, you can spot, you can almost like center something just by looking at it. But I think I can spot when things feel a little off. And then I also have the technical skills to make them accurate after.
I assume you don't mean you can center things easily because the little guide thing appears and snaps it into place. It just always comes so naturally to me and this little red line appears.
No, it's just like one example of this that came up recently is like sometimes in a button component, you'll see the text label and a trailing icon. And if the icon, the SVG icon is like inside of a box and there's like padding in that box or something, and you just like stick flex on that button or something, the space on either the padding on the inline part of the button, the left or right, is going to look unbalanced because the icon is in a box. So it's the edge of the check mark won't be hitting that right-hand padding. And every time I see something like that, I can't look away because it just feels off to me. But I don't know that everyone notices little details like that because they're probably used to seeing it look wrong. In my opinion,
some people post, and their favorite is Apple products, but some people post screenshots where they've shown that something's not aligned properly
in an official
Apple app. And what interests me the most is that these people obviously notice these things and are bothered by them, just like you say. But then the replies are basically saying, you're not allowed to be bothered by this. Like it's too small. And I can see both sides of the argument, but I find it interesting that people are so ready to dismiss them when it's like, it's a completely free post, you know, you don't have to follow them. I guess you can't ignore them necessarily because of the algorithmic timeline. You could mute them, I suppose. But it almost offends someone that other people do notice these things and then try to point them out. Because ideally, everything would be perfectly aligned in the world that should be. You know, some things intentionally shouldn't be.
Yeah. I just always feel for the companies on the other side of those tweets because I'm part of one that is often in those tweets, and it's like when people point things out, I think as someone who works at the company, your response is usually yes, we know, we're aware it sucks, but we don't have the time to fix it for whatever reason, or you know, we don't have enough people to fix it. So you're right, there's always going to be things that are imbalanced, so you can only control as much as you can control. Which is why I work on design systems, because then I can hopefully control everything.
Yeah. And this is something I think is probably a slow realization that happens across a interface design or a design career is you eventually realize that probably at any company where you respect their design skills in general, they will have noticed the thing that you've noticed, and they just cannot fix it because the priorities are wrong.
Yep.
And since every software company is basically operates that way, even the good ones, it becomes a lot easier to accept those things and say, okay, they've probably noticed it. It's not like I can assume that they're all useless, right? I can't.
Yeah.
So that makes it feel better, at least. It makes it feel like it's part of the world rather than something they're doing wrong.
And sometimes it works. If it gets enough traction, it will end up in the company Slack, probably. And someone will be like, okay, let me just cut a quick PR and fix it. We'll just fix it real quick. And then it's like, okay, well, I guess being mean on Twitter, sometimes you get what you want at the end. But yeah,
unfortunately, it works very often, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like this one ties into your thinking systematically point as well. You know, being able to, because I'm sure if you're designing components, you have to have a good awareness of things like layout, alignment, and white space.
Yeah.
Because you're setting the sort of archetypal, prototypical, whatever.
Yeah.
Sort of form of that thing. And so unless you get it right, it'll be wrong for everyone.
And I have a lot of numbers in my head. Like you kind of just, you get a sense of like, oh, we always use 8 pixels between an icon and a label or whatever it is. Like you sort of just recognize those things. So it's easier to manage them, I guess.
Yeah. And that's the thing about good visual design, especially classical aesthetics, right? Is you have to approach it systematically, even if you're not using a design system.
Mm-hmm.
You have to approach this one-off design you're doing systematically if you want it to look good, which is comforting to people like us.
Yeah.
My last one is identification, which I changed the name just so it would have an I in front. But what I mean is, and it's similar to the point you just made, seeing what's wrong.
Ah.
But beyond that, I don't mean I see that something is wrong. I mean I see what is wrong. And this is something I pride myself on because I posted about this recently, but I know that some people who are extremely good designers, I'm talking world class, they're probably being paid far more than I'm being paid. They will see a design and know that it's wrong, and that lets them iterate on it, but they didn't actually figure out what was wrong. And I really enjoy figuring out the why, so much so that I take the time to sort of pull it apart mentally, whereas probably they're just happy to identify that something's wrong and then start tweaking it again. And then they land on something that's right. And obviously that works because, you know, they're very successful designers. And so I'm not saying that they shouldn't do that. And if that's what they probably focus on other things that I'm not focused on that probably help them in other ways. But yeah, I really enjoy noticing that something's wrong and then stopping and being like, okay, let's pull this apart visually. I don't mean like in Figma, I mean in my head, you know.
Yeah.
And pinpointing. And I think that comes from giving a lot of feedback and looking at a lot of bad design, because you start to, like you're saying in your first point, you start to see the patterns.
Yeah.
And so you start to see, oh, this color combination or color combinations like it don't work. So if you have like a yellow and a gray, often they look bad, right? So, or yellowish and grayish, right? They can clash in ways that are not very nice. And so the next time you see a yellowish and a grayish thing together, you could be like, oh, okay, that's creating this sort of brown effect that I'm not a fan of. And one example that I've been not struggling with, but interested in recently is this idea that some colors make a website, for example, look too soft, or some color treatments. Mm. And so it'll be like quite feathery colors where they've like had a gradient and it's like transparent. The problem is I don't have words to describe it because I don't want to describe anything as soft because there are lots of associations with words like soft that sort of tie into gender associations from years gone and all these things, and I don't want to point at those, and so I struggle finding words to describe the problem when I see it. But I see it quite often when people aren't using color in a sort of intentional enough way. They've used the wrong color for that sort of background gradient, or the wrong color combination, and it ends up
fluffy.
Making all of these words are sort of associated with women, unfortunately. And I don't mean now, I mean, you know, 50 years ago or something. And so I'm trying to avoid anything that might be charged. But fluffy's sort of a good one. I think it's the opposite of has impact. And I don't know what that is.
Thesaurus.com.
My favorite doesn't design have impact. And so that's one I've been identifying recently and seeing a lot more of. And been frustrated because I can't describe it particularly mm-hmm. specifically. So I usually have to dance around it when I do tell the person, oh, this, this, and this.
Yeah.
I would change that because it doesn't have impact, which, yeah.
I think this is a good skill to have, especially in a scenario where you maybe are working with other designers and you share knowledge with them regularly. Like something we do at GitHub a lot is we record decisions that were made so that we have like a record of like why we're doing it this way or why we changed it or why we're not doing something. And I think if you can identify what is wrong with something, you can also document why that didn't work and why you did something differently so that if it comes up again in the future, like you have a record of that. And it's almost like creating principles in a way for your product.
Yeah, that's basically the process for creating rules. Yeah.
Mm.
And I used that once, which I really enjoyed because a lot of the rules I've written down are rules that I found from someone else. They'd written them down and then I took them and put them in a list. But I've created one rule myself, which is about percentages, rough percentages of brightness difference when you've got a container against a background, let's say, on a website. So you've got like a background that's, let's say, black, and then you've got a container that's a dark gray. It turns out there's a range of percentage differences of brightness in the HSB color, where if you go below that, it'll have too little contrast. And if you go above it, it'll have too much contrast. And from memory, it was something like 7 to 12% brightness.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, it was like 12% brightness difference between the background and the container. And so I went through like 100 different website background color combinations and realized that all of the ones that I liked were within this range of percentages.
Interesting.
And so I realized, oh, there's a rule around here where you should aim for, just like with line length, you should aim for that sort of number.
Yeah.
And because one day I realized that you basically never see white containers on a black background. So now that's one thing I look for when I'm trying to point out why this design doesn't feel right. It's because the background and the containers don't feel coherent because they're completely opposite ends of the brightness spectrum.
Yeah. That's a good one.
So yeah, I like that.
Since you just mentioned line length, I'm going to go into my last thing that I'm good at. I think typography is a strength of mine, which you might have said was a weakness of yours, I think. Yeah. Last week.
With qualifications, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. This is kind of similar to balance. I think I have an eye for typography. And then I also technically think I can understand how to make it more balanced. Even like our little logo for our podcast, I sat for a while kerning the letters in complementary because I wanted it to feel balanced. Again, just probably because of my graphic design background, you do a lot of kerning for print design and stuff like that, less so on the web. But it's a topic that you can go really deep into. And I think if I had a reason to at work, or something like that, or for a personal project, it would be easy for me to go deep into it. Like, I wouldn't be too much overhead for me to kind of figure out how variable fonts work again, or like type pairings and stuff like that. So, yeah.
It's quite fun.
It is fun.
It's interesting that you mentioned kerning, because I think a lot of people consider typography to be the sort of, they probably think of like the macro approach you have to take where you're laying out text on the page.
Oh yeah, well,
and then you're zooming into like that individual letter pairs, right? That's a lot more detail focused. Well, I guess it applies more to things like titles than body text.
Yeah, or logos, or like anything that's kind of more static that you can actually predict is where you would maybe want to kern. So, or like a podcast artwork.
Yeah. I think you can make an argument that kerning is like on the cusp. It's sort of the gray area of typography, because you probably do it more often if you're designing a logo.
Yeah. And
at that point, is it typography or is it logo design?
True.
But I wonder if anyone is laying out, I guess you can't do this for CSS yet, but I wonder if anyone's laying out body text on a website and kerning individual letter pairs in
I hope not. People do give, like, they reduce the letter spacing to try and achieve that, but I don't know. These things might be less important now that I think there's more focus on typography for the web. So the font itself should look good out of the box, probably. Out of the box, like it comes in a box. But you know what I mean.
It's a file.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, those are all of the things that we're good at.
It's a good list, I think.
Yeah.
It's a list of good and a good list.
Hopefully inspiring.
Yeah, nice. Get better at these, listeners.
Yeah, these are the only important things you need to know. It's good to reflect. The same way it's good to reflect on what you're not good at, it's also good to think about things that you are good at and figure out why.
Yeah, and it is a bit harder probably. So
yeah, I think so.
Maybe it's better to practice that than the things you're bad at. I'm sure we can all think of things we're bad at quite easily. But I was going to say, we've got a long list still of things that we can talk about on episodes, but maybe a friendly reminder that if you are listening and you have an idea for episode topics you want us to talk about, as long as they're interface design related, it's always interesting to see what people come up with.
Yes. Yeah. Please tweet at us with any ideas that you have. We'd love to hear them.
Although it will take us longer then to get to this entry in the list that says parody episode, which I...
We didn't end up...
My mind just lights up with ideas.
Maybe we should. Our 1 year is coming up pretty soon. So, yeah.
I feel like we probably discussed what that meant at the time. I don't know if it would still mean that by the time we get back to it. Maybe we'll have completely different ideas. We probably should have put more details in there, because are we parodying ourselves or are we parodying something else?
I literally don't remember where that idea came from.
No, okay. Well, that'll be fun when we do get around to it.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, thanks everyone for listening this week, and we'll catch you in the next one.
Yeah, thank you for talking.
Thank you for talking.